I was raised to believe that the Bible defines good and evil for us within its pages. But when we stop and examine this idea using the Bible, we discover something else. In the Garden of Eden, there were two trees, a tree that would bring life to all who ate of its fruit, and a tree that brought death. And it was the second tree, the tree that resulted in death, that contained the knowledge of good and evil. Have we been deceived by the serpent who is trying to get us to eat of the second tree? Is the Bible really trying to define good and evil for us? Let's take a step back. Let's run an experiment. Instead of seeking to define good and evil, let's instead ask the question of the trees. Let's attempt to define life and death, but to do so, we must first seek it out. So join us as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Hey everybody, welcome to the Derech Chai Experiment, the show where we meditate on scripture and in doing so, discover that we might have some things wrong when it comes to understanding the characters and motivations of those characters in scripture. There are two judges in the book of Judges who I believe receive a bad rap from modern people who misunderstand what's happening in their stories. The first is Gideon. We've already covered him. Gideon is often called a coward by commentators, teachers, and pastors because he's introduced as threshing out grain in a winepress, hiding from the hordes of Midian as he acts in rebellion to them. But frankly, I find this to be nothing more than a hot take and a misunderstanding. Say what you will about Gideon, but he was not a stupid man. He knew that the Midianites would overwhelm anyone who they caught hiding produce from them. He knew that he stood no chance of resisting, and doing so in the open gained no one anything. Gideon wasn't a coward. He was a brave man who was alone and had no one to support him, until God stepped in. The second judge who gets an undeserved bad rap is Samson. Yeah, he's not the best of people. He is not righteous in the usual sense. He is not kind or gentle or loving or self-controlled. He allows his flesh to dictate his actions, and it gets him in serious trouble repeatedly. But he was the man for the job that needed to be done, and in many ways it seems as if his own sense of importance gets him in trouble, because he knows that he was a child who was foretold of by God. He was appointed judge and deliverer from before birth, and he was a man who was powerful enough to enforce his sense of self-importance on others, because he was granted power from God as long as he kept a few simple rules. Don't cut your hair, and don't eat or drink from the vine. And it's in this area that Samson gets a bad rap where he doesn't deserve it, in my opinion. Despite all of his faults and all of his legitimate failings, Samson kept these rules. At least he kept these rules until outside forces acted upon him and forced a haircut upon him. And to be fair, he kinda asked for it, but that's not for this week. As I studied for this week, I found no end of commentators and teachers and pastors who make claims about Samson that are not stated in the Bible. And there are several ways of going about this, but the usual is to make the claim that Samson broke all the rules for a Nazarite except cutting his hair. The most common being that Samson drank wine and was a drunkard. In fact, it is wine that is often credited as the reason for why Samson makes such terrible decisions. And to make this point, they'll point to the word for feast that occurs in the story of his wedding. And since the Hebrew word for feast is closely associated with the Hebrew word for drinking, it's assumed that Samson was getting drunk alongside everyone else at the party. Samson threw this feast because it was the custom at a wedding in those days. What is not said is that Samson drank while at the party. In fact, Samson is never said to be drunk or to have taken a drink. Alongside this, these same commentators will point out that Samson was in a vineyard when he met the lion. Why would he be in a vineyard unless he was there picking grapes, they will say. Well, Timnah likely had a lot of vineyards. Perhaps his parents decided to take a shortcut and refresh themselves and they got separated for a time. The parents stopping to pick and eat some grapes while Samson continued on is a reasonable explanation for why they would get separated in a vineyard. Samson then goes on ahead of them and encounters a lion, kills it, and led his parents through the vineyard in a different direction. Simply being in a vineyard does not inherently mean that Samson broke this vow. In fact, these same commentators will make the claim that the Nazarite vow required that a person not touch anything made with grapes, which is not stated at all in Numbers chapter 6. Nazarites were not forbidden from touching grapes, they were forbidden from eating grapes. Finally, these commentators will say that Samson came near the corpse of a lion, which broke the Nazarite vow. Again, this just demonstrates the lack of understanding of the Nazarite vow and its requirements. A Nazarite was not forbidden from coming near any dead thing. If they were, they would be completely unable to offer a sacrifice during the terms of their vow, or even eating meat would be off the table. No, the Nazarite vow required that a person not come into contact with human corpses. How do I know? Because if a Nazarite breaks this vow, he has to go through a 7-day cleansing process, the very same cleansing process that's described in Numbers 19 with the ashes of the red heifer, which only applies to human corpses. In fact, I find it highly likely that the command about nearness to corpses didn't apply to those who were a Nazarite from birth. This is often not the choice of an individual, and a Nazarite from birth has no recourse to fix the issue, according to the Numbers 6 commands for the Nazarite, because it requires cutting their hair and starting the vow from the beginning. If there was a requirement to avoid human corpses for lifelong Nazarites, then how was Samson supposed to accomplish his mission? Why was he given strength to kill Philistines? Rather, I don't see this requirement as being a necessary requirement for the two individuals that we read of being Nazarites from birth, Samson and John the Baptist. Now, I came into my study of Samson assuming that Samson broke his Nazarite vows. After all, I have heard sermons, I have seen movies and read books on the topic, and nearly every one states in some ways that Samson was a drunkard. But after having read the entire account of Samson several times over the last few weeks, I cannot find a single mention of Samson drinking, being drunk, or breaking this vow in any way at all. I think that people arrive at this conclusion because why else would a person make the mistakes that Samson makes unless drink were involved? And I'll tell you why. Women. Because women were involved. While there is no biblical record of Samson being a drunkard or ever taking even a sip of wine, there is a lot of text that speaks about Samson's proclivity to fall for a pretty face. And in every story of Samson that we're going to read over the next few weeks, it always starts with a woman, specifically a Philistine woman. And this then leads to the conflict between Samson and the nation of the Philistines. Samson had a lot of faults, no doubt, but drunkenness does not seem to be one of them. In fact, pointing to drunkenness as the reason for Samson's stupidity glosses over the reason that is specifically stated in Scripture. Samson, like Solomon, had a weakness for foreign women. And Samson, like Solomon, would do anything to prove his love for these women, including giving away closely guarded secrets. And that's how this chapter begins, with Samson seeing a pretty face while in a Philistine city and deciding that he wanted this woman to be his wife. So let's open up to Judges 14 and let's read this first chapter, this first story of Samson, the final judge in the book of Judges. Judges chapter 14. And Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. And he went up and informed his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines, and now take her for me as a wife. But his father and his mother said to him, Is there no woman among the daughters of your brothers or among all my people that you should take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, Take her for me, for she is pleasing in my eyes. However, his father and mother did not know that this was of Adonai, that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines were ruling over Israel. Then Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, and came to the vineyards of Timnah, and saw a young lion roaring as it met him. And the spirit of Adonai came mightily upon him, and he tore it apart as the tearing apart of a young goat, with nothing in his hand. But he did not make known to his father or his mother what he had done. And he went down and spoke to the woman, and she pleased Samson well. And when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion and saw a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. And he took some of it in his hand and went along eating. And he came to his father and mother and gave them, and they ate. But he did not make known to them that he took the honey out of the carcass of the lion. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. And it came to be when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, Please let me put forth a riddle to you. If you clearly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I shall give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of garments. But if you are unable to explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen shirts and 30 changes of garments. And they said to him, Put forth your riddle, and let us hear it. And he said to them, Out of the eater came forth food, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And for 3 days they were unable to explain the riddle. And it came to be on the 7th day that they said to Samson's wife, Entice your husband to explain the riddle to us, or we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? And Samson's wife wept before him and said, You only hate me and do not love me. You have put forth a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. And he said to her, Look, I have not explained it to my father or my mother, and should I explain it to you? And she wept before him the 7 days while their feast lasted. And it came to be on the 7th day that he informed her, because she pressed him so much. She then explained the riddle to the sons of her people. And the men of the city said to him on the 7th day, before the sun went down, What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Then the spirit of Adonai came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck 30 of their men, stripped them, and gave the changes of garments to those who had explained the riddle. And his displeasure burned, and he went back up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his friend. In the ancient world, and even parts of the modern world, marriage was not something that was chosen by the people getting married. Married was a joining together of two families, and since this joining went beyond the people being married, it was the job of the parents to decide who their children were going to marry. The fathers of those being married would get together, draft an agreement, and let their children know that a spouse had been chosen for them. With this in mind, the story of Samson begins with a scandal on many fronts. Samson saw a woman, not a Hebrew woman, not a Danite woman, a Philistine woman. And Samson chose that this was the woman that he was going to marry and told his father to make it happen. Samson's parents initially pushed back, but Samson pressed them and they finally agreed. And at the end of verse 3, we see something interesting. It has been a while since I've covered this, but the story gives us perfect opportunity to return to this and consider it in light of this narrative. It's no secret that I love biblical patterns. They occur in many and various ways throughout the Bible. One way that they occur is through repetition of words, phrases, or ideas, and one of the most fundamental patterns in the Bible is the pattern of temptation. This pattern is first introduced in Genesis 3 when the serpent places the fruit before Eve and tempts her to eat of it. When Eve stops and examines the fruit, she notices three things. Genesis 3:6. And the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. The fruit that was forbidden was good, pleasing to the eyes, and desirable. This pattern repeats throughout the Bible in nearly every situation in which a person is tempted, and the Bible explores that to any degree. And in many other cases, it is a sexual relationship that serves as a stand-in for the fruit from the tree. For example, Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. Abraham needed an heir. Sarah saw Hagar, determined that she was good for a mother, and desirable to give an heir to Abraham. So Sarah took Hagar, gave her to her husband, and nothing but heartache followed. Or we can look to David. David stayed home from the war that he commanded. While in his palace, he saw Bathsheba. She was good for, well, a good time, pleasing to the eyes, and so he took her and caused no end of hurt to his nation, his family, himself, and those that served him faithfully. Well, here in the story of Samson, we see this pattern being laid out. Samson sees this woman, desires her, and takes her because she is pleasing to the eyes. The forbidden fruit of the Philistine woman, Samson's continual weakness that leads to no end of personal tragedy. Well, Samson's parents give in to his request, and they make the necessary arrangements with her family for Samson to marry her. Now, the biblical author makes a note in the text that this entire scenario was planned by God for the purpose of riling up the Philistines against Samson, so that Samson would then, in response, have a reason to fight them. something that is extremely important, but which isn't important at this moment, so we'll return to it later. On the way to the initial meeting, an encounter with a lion occurs, and in this encounter it is said that Samson tore apart the lion as one would tear apart a young goat with his bare hands. Again, this is taken in all sorts of ways, but usually modern commentators take it to mean that he ripped open its jaws or choked it out. And neither is how you rip apart a young goat. Now, this next part is going to be a bit graphic, but this is a graphic book, so here goes. How many of you have witnessed or seen a person pick up a chicken by their head and fling it about to snap its neck? This is a very simple and effective way to kill a chicken without using a blade. Well, there are ways to kill many animals without a blade, and when it comes to goats, one of the ways that this was practiced was to grab it by its hind legs, usually with two people, and pull in opposite directions very quickly. When this is done, the animal rips down the center and the guts and viscera separate themselves from the carcass, and all that's left is the meat of the animal and the skin. Cleaning then becomes a much easier task, even if the skin is ruined to some degree. What is being described here is the same process. Somehow, Samson apparently got a hold of the lion's back legs and pulled them in opposite directions and ripped the animal in two. And this was only possible because the spirit of Adonai came down on Samson and gave him the strength to accomplish this feat. But he didn't tell his parents about this. He kept it to himself. That's not the actions of a prideful man. He did not brag about the lion. And somehow, he kept even his bloody clothes from his parents. I get the impression that he was scared of what had happened, that he was shocked at the inhuman strength that he had just exhibited. If they found out, they would treat him different and make a big deal about it, so best to keep it quiet. You see, I don't think Samson sought the approval of others in any way. He was self-assured and confident, and he went about his business and did what he wanted despite what others might say. His pride was the pride of the lone wolf who didn't need others to keep him in check. I kind of identify with Samson, as it's easier to be confident and just do what I want than to enter into the messy and painful process of dealing with other people. Well, things go well with this initial visit to the woman and her family, and so a return trip becomes necessary for Samson to finalize the marriage. On the way, Samson stops to check out that lion he killed a while back. Perhaps it was a sense of morbid curiosity, but I find it more likely that he kind of wanted to confirm that it had really happened. I mean, if I did something like this and walked away for a long time, I might begin to wonder if it had happened at all or if I had just made it up. So when I later got the opportunity to confirm, I would take it. Well, when Samson confirms, he finds that bees have taken up residence in the carcass of the lion, presumably after it had been picked clean by birds and wild animals. Well, Samson gets to his soon-to-be in-laws, and since he didn't bring any friends because he's a lone wolf, they provide him with 30 Philistine companions to fill out the celebration and the party. Well, during the party, Samson poses a riddle. Now, this was not uncommon, as there was not a lot of options for entertainment during a week-long feast. In fact, questions and riddles were extended from the host of banquets of various sorts. We have records from the 3rd century BC of Greek banquets requiring a riddle or a question to be posed by the host as one of several forms of entertainment at a feast. The riddle that was to be posed was to be difficult, but not so difficult that it couldn't be figured out. But the riddle that Samson offers seems a bit disingenuous as it doesn't conform to that standard. It's the sort of riddle that you expect from Bilbo Baggins as he speaks to Gollum. "What have I got in my pocket?" sort of riddle. It's the sort of riddle that can only be answered by a person with experience in the subject matter. But it does present itself as a riddle better than Bilbo's because it does include a dichotomy that teases the mind. Out of the eater came something to eat. Predators are rarely food, especially in the ancient Near East, so what devourer could also provide a meal? And strong things are rarely sweet. Usually they're musty or sweaty when it comes to the smell or taste or even interaction. The strong are rarely sweet. Well, obviously these men don't know the answer to this riddle because they don't have the personal experience that's so fresh in Samson's mind. So they turn to trickery to get the answer from him. Now, if Samson had just posed the riddle, there likely would not have been a problem. But Samson saw an opportunity to get one over on his Philistine overlords, so he made the riddle a wager. And since the companions had something to lose, they turned to Samson's new bride and threatened her if she did not give the answer. Now let's recognize that the threat that is made here is the exact same threat that Ephraim made to Jephthah just a few chapters before. It was not an idle threat, because we discover in the next chapters that the Philistines do in fact carry out this execution in this way after Samson destroys the produce of the Philistines. This poor girl is in a no-win situation. If she stays true to her husband, she and her family will be burned alive. But when she does betray her husband, well, she's still burned alive. Samson puts this girl and this family in the situation simply because he liked her pretty face. Her life is now on the line because he didn't consider the consequences of his actions. And so she does what she can, and as a woman, she can actually do quite a lot. All it takes is for her to pester Samson and to connect the answer to the question to the legitimacy of his love for her, and he finally gives in and shares the answer to his riddle. Well, because of this, those who should have never guessed the riddle do guess it, and Samson accurately deduces why they were able to do so. But the simple fact is that he now owes 30 sets of clothing to these 30 Philistine men. And so, Samson takes to murdering. He goes to Ashkelon, which is about 30 miles from Timnah, in order to kill 30 Philistines, take their clothes in order to fulfill the bargain that he had initially proposed. And then he leaves behind his wife and goes home to his parents. And because it seems as if Samson has rejected his new bride, his new father-in-law, who has been left with the defiled daughter and no husband for her, gives her away to the lead companion at the wedding. Now, there's a lot going on in this chapter, and I've hinted at some of it, but let's touch on it a bit deeper. First off, there's a lot of foreshadowing happening in this chapter. The lion and the bees, they serve as symbols of the Philistines for the astute reader. What was it that the Philistines relied upon to exert their control? Very powerful individuals, giants who were difficult to defeat in battle. How do we know this? Because just a few decades later, a young man named David kills a Philistine giant named Goliath. And because it is declared at the end of the conquest narrative in Joshua that the only place that the Anakim remained was in Philistine territory, Joshua 11:22, there was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod did some remain. You see, Samson is the final judge, and his defeat of the Philistines is the final chronological event in the book of Judges. If we are worried about chronology, then when Samson dies, we should immediately turn to 1 Samuel and the warfare between the Philistines and Israel that we find in those initial chapters of Samuel is that same warfare that was continuing from this time of Samson. And the Philistines, well, they relied heavily upon the great strength of the giants and also upon their numbers to overwhelm. We see this clearly in the narrative leading up to David and Goliath. Symbolically, this is represented as a lion and bees as foreshadowing of the forces that Samson and that Israel is pitted against. And the motion that he would have used in killing the lion, pulling his hands apart from each other, points us forward to the motion of pushing down the pillars later in the story, the means by which Samson ultimately defeats this particular lion. We also find the foreshadowing of Samson being tricked into giving away a secret to his woman because she questions his love for her repeatedly. This points us forward to when Samson gives away the ultimate secret of his strength to another woman who uses the exact same tactics. In fact, Samson as a character foreshadows another character that will arrive later in the Bible, because there are a lot of parallels going on in this chapter between Samson and David. David was appointed by God at a young age. David began by killing a lion and a bear, but he did not tell anyone about it until just before he faced off with the Philistines for the first time. David killed many Philistines at one time in connection to his marriage. The issue of their circumcision is also in play in the story of David, as it is when Samson's father mentions the uncircumcised Philistines in verse 3. David's first wife was then given to another man by her father when he ran away from the threat. David succumbed to the sight of a pretty lady, which led to a greater tragedy and disaster with personal consequences. The parallels in these two characters should not be overlooked, and the list that I've given is not exhaustive. They have similar strengths, similar weaknesses, the same enemy, and the same Spirit of God is upon them. And likewise, Samson serves as a microcosm of Israel as a whole, not as a foreshadowing, but as an individual version of the larger story of the book of Judges. Israel was chosen by God. They were given instructions to avoid certain things. They defeated the great lion of the Canaanites in the conquest and were left fending off the bees of what remained in order to claim the land of milk and honey. But Israel loved the ways of their pagan neighbors. They joined them in marriage and worship. And this joining together with the nations led to their betrayal by those nations, and the pagans ruled over them. But Israel, empowered by God, rose up and fought off the enemy, only to succumb once more to the exact same tactics of the enemy, just as Samson will fall once more for a pretty Philistine face who tricks him into giving away a secret using the exact same excuse. Finally, we can see that God intended for this to happen. God gave Samson a desire for foreign women so that Samson could be exposed to their treachery, so that he would fight them and in the end defeat them. God made Samson into the sort of person who would mimic what Israel as a whole had done and create a lesson for the people to learn from. And this is where I want to focus as I close. Last week we used the description of the angel's words and how Manoah responded to highlight that Samson's family was not in a place where they understood the Torah or righteousness fully, but that we should not focus on their failures and condemn them for these, because God did not condemn them. He met them where they were at. Rather, we need to focus on ourselves and recognize that God met them where they were and didn't condemn, but rather gave gifts and showed honor. Well, this week let's take it one step further. It's all too common in today's culture for a person to be outed as a sinner and for them to then be canceled by everyone around them. There are countless examples of men who misused their position to gratify their flesh. And while one minute we see them as a shining example of God working through men, the moment we find out about their sin, we condemn them and declare that God can no longer work through them. Or if he does, he can't do so in my life. I'm thinking of recent examples such as Mike Bickle or Ravi Zacharias, men who dedicated their lives to serving God in ministry, but who, in the end, were revealed to be human. Men who, like David, abused their position of power to engage in illicit sexual encounters. The problem in this is not that the men were sinners, it's that the men were put on pedestals and made out to be more than mere men. And then when they are proven to be just men who suffer from the same sort of temptations as each one of us, who then gave in to the temptation and let it overcome them, we are forced to tear them down as we recognize that we may have created idols out of these men. But the truth of Scripture from one end to the other is that God uses imperfect men. He must use imperfect men because there is no other. Just because a man has been caught in a scandal does not mean that God did not choose them or that they are no longer capable of serving him. Just as Samson is still used by God and just as David was still used by God. All too often we fall into this trap. A man makes a mistake and we discard him as not truly being of God, as a wolf who's preying on sheep. But when we do so, we make the same mistake that I spoke on last week, but from a different perspective. Instead of looking down on others because they do not seem as righteous as we are, we find that we have elevated others because they seem more righteous than we are. It's the same issue, judging where others are before God, making them out to be more closer to God in some ways this time, more righteous and more acceptable than us. But the problem is that all humans are human, and the temptation often gets greater the more that God asks you to do. We have to stop comparing ourselves to others, either looking down on them from our pedestal or putting them up on the pedestal. Men are wicked and evil, and the human heart is treacherous. Once again, we need to put only one man on a pedestal, and that is Yeshua, our Messiah. Every other man will fail you. Every other man will sin. Every other man will create and cause victims and has done so already. So let's focus only on ourselves and our relationship to God, and please stop making idols out of men. When we can look to God as our guide, regardless of what man is appointed to the position of authority, we will find that living our lives becomes much easier. So let's Derech Chai. Let's seek life in all that you do. Shalom. Thank you for tuning in to Derech Chai. If this content has blessed you and you would like more, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, and sharing with others. To find out more about what we do and to support this ministry, head over to seeklifesc.com. That's seeklifesc.com. We'll see you again next time as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Shalom.